Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. And this week, we've only got two films to look at because they clearly put one out and thought, just one more will do this week. So we are looking at Baz Luhrmann's opulent biopic Elvis and seeing if Blumhouse's latest chiller can put the willies up us with the black phone. But first of all, before we get onto those, what have you been watching? Matt, have you seen your final episode of Obi-Wan yet?
Well, no. As we record, this is Wednesday morning and I overslept today, so I didn't get time to watch the
dirty stopping bedder.
Well, normally, like, I've got young children, so we're never ever set an alarm and we're always awake before six, but today, the day we're in a rush and have a lot to do in the morning, of course they sleep in, so yeah, so that was a bit of a disaster. But yes, I've been sort of enjoying the first five episodes that I've seen so far, but I perhaps haven't loved it quite as much as I hoped. I was sort of absolutely desperate to see it before it came out, and it was one of my most sort of anticipated viewing things, you know, including films and TV of the year. But it sort of hasn't quite lived up to my expectations, but I've been sort of enjoying it well enough. And I also caught up with a film that you reviewed last week, Lightyear, which I went to see at the cinema. And
now, come on, Matt, what do you think? Because you are a Pixar like mega fan. How did it work for you?
I thought it was perfectly enjoyable. Definitely not up there with the very top tier, but certainly for me, better than just, you know, completely average, generic animated films you often might get dragged along to or sort of, you know, sat down in front of a Sunday afternoon, because definitely not in the top tier and, you know, somewhat generic and perhaps ultimately a bit of a flawed premise, because maybe Buzz just wasn't the best character to kind of single out like this, because he sort of, you know, he works best when he's sort of subverting that like straight-laced space ranger image, you know, in when he's just a kind of, you know, they're kind of mocking that when he's a toy, you know, a sort of self-serious toy. But I still thought it was just very enjoyable, very easy to watch. I absolutely loved the kind of time dilation montage scene. I think that was a moment that sort of separated it again from just a bog standard generic animation, you know, you might see. So yeah. I thought it was enjoyable enough, but maybe
it's not done brilliantly at the box office, has it? It's been a disappointment at the box office. People have stayed away.
I think I say this as a Pixar devotee. I think people have been a bit harsher at its box office performance. It's still had the biggest opening of any animated film since the pandemic times, but it wasn't quite as high as, you know, people were hoping. So it's obviously the story's now become, it's a massive failure. And then I sort of think whenever these stories come out, that then feeds into like what people think. And so, like, for example, with Top Gun, it has the positive effect of it where that's kind of exceeding all expectations. So it's constantly getting these positive headlines of like, wow, you know,
it's still number one.
So that
no, it's number one in Korea.
And that just encourages more and more people to see it. Lightyear opens with a respectable like 51 million or something. And it's like, oh, Pixar have lost it. You know, it's all downhill. So then you start then, you know, I guess that feeds into the sort of just general vibe of like, oh, it's done badly. I'm not going to bother seeing that. It's bad, you know, so.
Top Gun's become one of those films that literally everyone seems to be talking about. You listen to people on the tube and they're talking about it, or it's just transcended that, you know, it's gone beyond film fans.
It's just popular culture now, isn't it? It's not just
your mother and father
like
will probably go and see it.
Yeah.
Possibly. My father probably wouldn't, but, you know, generally speaking, it seems to have transcended that moment. But Lightyear, I don't think probably would, but.
Oh no.
And that's a lot to put on the shoulders of a kid's film, isn't it? To expect it to perform in the same way, really.
Yeah. It probably helped me that I saw it with a child as well. So it was kind of, I was very much in the sort of that headspace that I sort of approached it thinking I would have just loved this film if I was like 7 years old and I went to see it. It was just kind of geared towards that age, I think. And
now you need to buy a socks, I assume.
Well, absolutely, yes.
Where socks is the robot companion? That's what the child is asking now. James, what have you been watching?
Well, I've been watching a bit late to the party on this one, but I've just started watching Severance, the Apple TV.
I have as well, James. Show. I've just started. Ah, I'm also late.
And how many episodes are you in?
Three episodes in I am now.
I'm about four and a half, so I won't spoil the next one and a half for you. But yeah, well, I'm sure you'd agree. It's completely bizarre and weird and fascinating and fantastic. I don't know how many listeners have caught it yet, but it's this show directed by Ben Stiller. starring Adam Scott, who I've always loved as an actor. Never thought he quite had the kind of lead role that he really deserves. And I think he's perfect in this as a kind of worker working in this bizarre office where your outside memories have been sort of divorced from your memories at work. It's very, very strange and really fascinating to see where it's going. It's got Christopher Walken, John Turturro in it, Dishan Lakman, who was in the recent Jurassic film. Really interesting cast. Patricia Arquette. So, yeah, loving that so far. And then I went to see Thief, which was the Michael Mann film from 1981 that was playing at the BFI South Bank the other day, which was fantastic. Never seen that on the big screen before. Tangerine Dream soundtrack. If you want a bit of synth, that was just fantastic. I love fantastic.
Tangerine Dream.
Yep. You can't not love Tangerine Dream. James Caan, of course, in the lead as a professional safecracker. Yeah, fantastic film. If you've never seen it, dig it out. It's kind of like a precursor in some ways to Heat, you know, Mann's kind of classic opus from 1995. So, yeah, I've been digging into some old things this week.
I've been watching famous people present their programmes in a wooden fashion at the Paramount Plus launch. That's what Matt and I were at that party on Monday. We were surrounded by reality stars who we didn't have a clue who they were and had to look up on the Daily Mail. So that's how out of touch we are.
You mean in the audience this was, the reality stars?
There was Geordie Shore people and Essex people there, and
because it's important that they're there, obviously, as sort of entertainment reporters.
Very important. But there was Kevin Costner there talking about Yellowstone.
You must have been very excited about that.
I was very pleased about that. He was wearing some great cowboy boots. Sylvester Stallone turned up to talk about his new show, Tulsa King.
Sylvester Stallone absolutely stole the show as well. He was the one who came out kind of right at the end. I think he was possibly the last one to head out, and he was just like, sod the auto cue, I'm just doing this. And then wherever I came out and just sort of read off the auto cue for a minute or so. He did a good kind of 6 or 7 minutes where he was just talking, and it was just so funny and so entertaining and so self-deprecating that it was just, it was amazing. That was the highlight for me.
Totally. I mean, I don't really think I've really had a concept of what he's like in real life. To me, he's like that quite serious action guy that did Planet Hollywood and, you know, is just sort of posing a lot. But he was so self-deprecating, making jokes about never being at home with his kids, about, you know, being old and long in the tooth, and just full of stories and an absolute showman, wasn't he? Like proper star wattage. And, you know, we were sitting with directors and other sort of celebrities, and all of them were in awe of this guy just doing this bit on stage. So it was really, really a good night out. Great cocktails, great canapes, a blue carpet. What more could you want? So that's what I've been watching. But shall we move on to see what we can watch at the cinema on a big screen now?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, it is time to shake, rattle, and roll with this.
He was my destiny.
I wish to promote you, Mr. Presley.
One room party in a town of jail.
Are you ready to fly?
I'm ready. Ready to fly.
Tomorrow, all of America will be talking about Elvis Presley. What is
done to you? President Donald, move around so much
during the take. I can't move, I can't sing.
So this is Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, biopic of the King. How is this different from what we've seen before, Matt?
This is very, very, very sort of razzle-dazzle, classic Baz Luhrmann style. You know, you definitely know you're watching a film from the director of Moulin Rouge when you watch this, I would say. And it's sort of, I knew from, obviously, if you read Total Film Magazine, you'd have seen Jane's feature recently interviewing Baz Luhrmann and star Austin Butler about the film. So I kind of knew from being prepared on that it kind of looked at these different stages of his life, from his kind of young life starting out to, you know, his kind of, you know, glory years to then the Vegas years at the end. And I sort of almost half.
Wait a minute. Like, the Vegas years are the glory years. What are you talking about?
Well, you know, this is the second wave of glory years at the end. And I sort of almost half expected it to be like Jobs, like, you know, the Steve Jobs biopic by Danny Boyle, where I thought it might be three extremely distinct, you know, like sections like that, where it was more of a sort of full life biopic than I was expecting. It's basically, it's Elvis's life story, but done in such a way that, yes, it has that, really has that Moulin Rouge type musical flavor to it, where obviously, of course, you get lots and lots of Elvis music and performances in it, but there's also kind of, you know, just music is so important, and there's kind of new music mixed in with old music. And the other thing that perhaps maybe differentiates it from films I've seen before is it really is the kind of key relationship in the film is between Austin Butler's Elvis and Colonel Tom Parker's manager, who is played by Tom Hanks. And it's basically all about how this sort of impresario, Svengali type figure wants to kind of turn this amazing performer into like the ultimate carnival act, really. And it's about that kind of their dynamic across the years and how, you know, on the one hand, he obviously does help create this just absolute sensation, but at what cost, you ask?
At what cost? So, yeah, is Elvis the showbiz sacrificial lamb in all of this? James, let's start off then talking about Austin Butler and his performance. This film hinges on whether the actor playing Elvis can actually, you know, pull it off. Does he?
Absolutely nails it, basically. The physical performance on stage, first of all, I mean, we should say that his voice is used for the songs in the early part of Elvis's career. Then I think Lerman blended in the real Elvis's voice later on. But vocally, what he does in those early scenes is fantastic. But for me, I was completely taken by his physical presence on stage, the sort of hip wiggling, knee trembling style that we know Elvis for. And I mean, when I interviewed Butler, he was saying that he actually had to, this is a year, at least a year after he'd rapped, that he had to go for an MRI scan the next day because his back was still kind of thrown out.
Bust a knee, didn't he, from all of his like leg wiggling that he did. And
but you can see it, that what he's doing on stage is exactly what Elvis was doing, and it's way, way beyond an impersonation, let's say. I mean, there's a sort of one of the concert scenes, it's about halfway through the film, I think, where he's got all these women sort of staring at him, and he's kind of kissing them almost on stage or coming into the audience. And that kind of chemistry and electricity he has in those scenes was absolutely incredible. I completely bought him as Elvis, I have to say. As I say, it went way, way beyond an impersonation. And then it's not just the concert scenes. Of course, there's plenty of dialogue-driven scenes as well when he's at home with Priscilla, his wife, who he meets when he's sent to Germany, when he has to do a stint in the army, and she's played by Olivia de Jong. He has some love me tender moments as well, if you can excuse the Elvis pun.
Lovely.
but he does, you know, he can play those quiet dramatic scenes as well. I completely think I know it's way, way too early to talk about the Oscars, but he feels like an absolute front runner to me.
Oh, God, absolutely. I mean, totally.
I think he's the one to beat.
I totally bought him as Elvis. In fact, just his speaking voice is incredible. And the nuance that he puts into the way an Elvis at 19 speaks to the difference at Elvis in 1968, who's a star and a man, fully grown man with a bit of a raspy voice, to the man who's in Vegas. Like, you can totally recognize that is absolutely Elvis, but in different stages of his life. And I think that's an incredible achievement by Butler, considering his first shot that he did was Elvis in 68 at the Hollywood sign, which you'll see when you see the film. And the next day he had to do the 68 special, which is him in the black leather. And the day after that, he had to do Elvis at 19. All the time frames are shifting around, obviously, because they do not film films in order, as we know. But to be able to nail who he is in any given era and do it so completely convincingly, I think it's an incredible performance. And I would say better than Rami Malek doing... Freddie, would you agree?
I think he had more to do than Rami Malek in some ways. I think Rami Malek's amazing in that film when I saw that. I mean, I think he really captured Freddie on stage. But yeah, I feel like, as you say, there was probably a bigger era for Austin to sort of go, you know, as you say, go from sort of the 19, 20-year-old Elvis right through to sort of 42. That's a big arc to traverse. And he does capture him in different stages really, really well. So, well, if Rami won it for Bohemian Rhapsody, then there's no reason why Austin shouldn't. I mean, we have no idea who he's going to come up against, of course, you know, in whatever it is, 6 months' time.
But this is a performance that actors who do vote in these categories, you know, they like this sort of performance. This is a person who, for 2 years, put his life on hold, just what lived and breathed Elvis. He talked to his sister on the phone in that voice. He couldn't shake it. And even now, I'm sure you agree, James, when you talk to him now, Elvis is still there in him. His voice still sounds Elvis. His mannerisms are still Elvisy. He's still got a quiff. It's really this inhabiting a role. And I just think the Academy love that sort of thing. You know, if, you know, Tammy Faye got it last year with Jessica Chastain, they love people that really put on the wigs, put on the makeup and inhabit the role. So I do think he's the one to beat. Let's talk about Tom Parker then, who is this sort of Falstaff character to Elvis's Prince Hal, which is what Tom Hanks sort of viewed it as. This Barker, this carnival Barker, who sees the money he could make in this young boy from Tupelo and decides he's going to market him. He hasn't any interest in the music. He's interested in the dollars. We don't know as much about Parker as we do about Elvis, and we're not as familiar. What did you think of Tom Hanks essaying this sort of nefarious, dark, shadowy figure in Elvis's life, Matt?
I must admit, this is like Tom Hanks's performance was one of the elements I was less convinced by with the whole film. And I ended up kind of giving into it eventually and accepting it as part of the film, because obviously the film is so kind of stylishly vibrant and sort of, you know, like so full on and so much energy that I kind of accepted it as part of the sort of register that the film was playing in. But I must admit, I wasn't totally convinced by, but obviously, you know, anyone who's probably seen any trailers or images from the film, he's got this kind of crazy prosthetic sort of fat suit on. And I did find it all a bit distracting and a bit sort of cartoony, I must say. And I found that side of the story interesting, but I was never entirely convinced that it was the ideal casting for me. But what did you guys make of it?
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. I like the idea of using Parker as the effectively the unreliable narrator, the sort of framing device. But I think it would have been better if it had been cast like Butler, you know, being
a sort of relative unknown.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah. You know, Hanks is obviously a very, you know, assured performer. But this just perhaps because of the fat suit and the kind of cod European, possibly Dutch accent that he's got going on, just felt a little distracting. Like you, Matt, I sort of in the end just gave into it. And although he does comment on the action, he becomes less important in the last third of Elvis's life, it feels like. So perhaps by then I was more invested in the Elvis-Priscilla relationship than I was in sort of Parker's activities. I mean, right at the beginning, we see him kind of from his hospital bed sort of looking back. So we know he's slightly less important in Elvis's sort of final years, you could say. But yeah, that wasn't one of the most convincing elements for me. But it wasn't by any means a disaster or anything that upends the movie or anything like that.
For me, I mean, you know, this is, as we discussed at the beginning, this is a Lerman film. And this is just like the impresario from Moulin Rouge, a ridiculous sort of over-the-top ringmaster that Baz likes to put in a film. And so it's sort of, for me, in terms of his sort of oeuvre, his canon, it felt like it sat fine with the sort of things that Baz does. But yeah, I am aware of Colonel Tom Parker and what he looked like and sounded like. And he didn't talk in that weird an accent. I mean, admittedly, you know, the thing about Parker that's interesting is he's not a colonel. He's not a Tom and he's not even a Parker. He's a, you know, a Dutch emigre who never had a US passport. And that's one of the reasons for the difficulties in the relationship with Elvis. But he's a carnival act himself. He is all smoke and mirrors, and nothing is actually real about him, and what he might advise in order to get what he wants isn't necessarily the right thing. So for me, it was very cartoony and carnival, but then maybe that's the point. So I sort of let it wash over me. And I did think that Butler and Hanks together had a really interesting chemistry. As you say, James, there's some talking bits, and it's not all just shaking your hips bits. But between those two characters, there's a real sadness and a real tenderness and a real sort of codependency and just toxic relationship going on there that I feel isn't just sort of one level. There's a lot of nuance in it. And I do think that the fact that Hanks, who's a great actor, is bringing that to the table, there is that sort of light and shade there that I really enjoyed. Let's talk about then, if you aren't into Elvis, is this a film that anybody can enjoy? You know, like, for a long time, Elvis has just been, you know, the jumpsuit that you buy for Halloween or the gold glasses you can buy for your stag do. Is this going to make you think differently about the King of Rock and Roll, Matt?
It did for me, because I kind of come from that position of not being like the biggest Elvis fan, not being particularly knowledgeable. Actually, my main knowledge of Elvis comes from, we actually did a module on Elvis in GCSE history at school. So that was a long time ago. And that was where all my knowledge came from. And obviously, I vaguely remember seeing sort of certain documentaries on TV when I was younger. But it made me see him in new eyes. One, because of what we're talking about, Austin Butler's performance. And one of the most striking ones for me, I mean there's several great, great performances in here, but his kind of very first proper on stage one, where you see the crowd going like absolutely wild. I just kind of totally believed that. And I totally kind of, from his performance and the reaction to it, I really sort of really got a sense of how this would have felt at the time and how kind of radical he would have been as a performer and how new it would have all felt and how exciting. So that was kind of fresh for me. And also it sort of gave me a new, especially with Austin playing the character across the timelines, it made me realize just quite how young Elvis was kind of when he died. And as a kid, when you're sort of aware of him as this huge kind of cultural figure, to you as a kid, he just looked so old in his sort of in the 70s. Whereas you think, wow, he was actually really not old at all. And so that showed me that through fresh eyes as well, really.
I do know a reasonable amount about Elvis. I mean, my father is a massive Elvis fan, so I grew up kind of
indoctrinated.
Well, yeah, and probably not liking him as a child, because you don't like your parents' music. But, you know, I have grown up to appreciate what a good singer he was, how amazing some of those songs are. And I think this film really does show that as well. And there were things I learned in this film that I didn't know. Like, we've all probably heard, even if you only vaguely know a bit about Elvis, the 68 comeback special, where he's wearing the black leather after his career's been a bit in the doldrums for a while. That's a very famous sort of TV special that he did. I was well aware of that, but I didn't know that it sort of, which the film very much shows, that it had come out of this sort of Christmas special that the Colonel had tried to sort of arrange with the TV company. And then you see him in the film wandering around in his Christmas jumper, which is quite funny. And I had no idea that it got sort of effectively hijacked and turned into this raw performance that Elvis gives. So, you know, there was plenty that I learned. And then I think by the end, I have to say, I felt quite emotional, probably partly because of my, you know, childhood associations with Elvis. And sort of, I came out of the screening and immediately texted my father, who I should add never goes to the cinema, but he is aware of this film. And I texted him and said, I've seen it. It's very good. I think he will go and see it. I mean, I'll make him go and see it, basically, because he needs to go and see this, because I know he will enjoy it. But that's obviously someone who is an Elvis fan, an Elvis devotee. People are in their teens or 20s. I'm curious to see how they would react to a film like this, because they won't know a lot about him. I think Baz Luhrmann himself said most kids probably only know Elvis from Lilo and Stitch, because there's lots of Elvis tracks in life. But, you know, that might well plug back into their childhood, strangely. And they're like, oh, yeah, those songs from Lilo and Stitch. I don't know much about that singer, but maybe I'll go and watch the film. I think we should probably give some love as well to the early section of the film, where you've got, well, first of all, you've got Richard Roxburgh playing his dad, who I think is brilliant in the film, this kind of really weak, pathetic figure in some ways. Then you've got, very early on, Elvis is on this sort of country kind of tour when he's not that famous, and he's got David Wenham playing Hank Snow and Cody Smith McPhee, who we saw in Power of the Dog recently, playing Jimmy Rogers Snow. I think they're really good. They set the scene really nicely. A bit later on, you've got Kelvin Harrison Jr. playing B.B. King and Alton Mason playing Little Richard. So that's where
astonishing. Burns up the screen as him as well.
Absolutely. They obviously influence Elvis's sort of love of blues and things like that. So it then leads into this middle section where you get this incredible montage of Elvis's movies. I thought that was absolutely brilliant.
They do it in the style of an Elvis movie. So it's like water skiing and it's very knowing.
Brilliant. And then it absolutely accelerates into that, as I mentioned, the 68 comeback special and the Vegas years sequence. And that was such a sort of high, that moment. And then, you know, I'm not going to talk about the end, but I just thought it was very dignified the way they dealt with his final years. I've seen at least a review complaining that it didn't go into, you know, some of the more unseemly aspects of his final years. And I thought, actually, no, I thought Lerman dealt with it very, very well in a very dignified manner. Yeah, I thought it was really well handled at the end.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't go into, you know, Elvis turning up to see President Nixon, or
although
know,
apparently that scene
part of the FBI, which we've seen in Frost Nixon before.
Well, that scene, apparently there was a story I read that there's a 4-hour cut and that Elvis meeting Nixon scene was shot. But if that's entirely true, I don't know.
I'll be buying that when Baz releases that on DVD, I can tell you. You mentioned quite a few points there we probably should touch on, James, like the fact that for young people, how does Baz contextualize Elvis? And I guess one of the ways is the way he's always done it, which is to reframe historic things, Shakespeare or whatever, with a modern artist. So Gatsby, he reframed with Jay-Z. Romeo and Juliet, he reframed Shakespeare with this sort of lurid pop kind of True Romance style. With Moulin Rouge, it's David Bowie songs that are in, you know, sort of Parisian Paris. For this one, he's got Eminem on the soundtrack. He's got Dojo Cat. He's got, you know, various new artists reinterpreting Elvis's songs. But also, I think we probably should mention that he does reframe Elvis within Black music and Black culture, and really tries to show that without that, there would not have been an Elvis Presley, and we wouldn't have seen this, you know, cataclysmic sort of change in pop music, where people are sitting there, as you mentioned, on the Hayride scene, sitting there expecting someone to come on and strum a guitar nicely, and they get this performance that is born from Elvis's love of gospel and his love of Beale Street and the blues and the performers that he's been watching. It's dangerous to Southern society. What is this that they're seeing? I've seen some reviews that have complained about this and said this is sort of like the woke revisionism of Elvis. Did you feel like that was, you know, trying to revise his legacy, or did you feel that that was a true representation?
Well, Jane, from my GCSE history module, I sort of was aware of that, and I knew that the Ku Klux Klan really didn't like Elvis, you know, for those reasons. So that felt right to me, and it felt right to kind of, you know, show the roots of the music like that. And I don't think it did it in a sort of heavy-handed way. It was all just kind of part and parcel with his sort of upbringing.
Yeah, I didn't feel it was a woke revisionist attempt by Lerman at all, actually. I mean, it's undoubtedly exactly what happened. You know, Elvis grew up in, you know, in the Deep South, and, you know, he mixed with, you know, young Black kids. I mean, and he absorbed their music. I mean, I don't think that's inaccurate at all.
Well, I am an Elvis fan and a bit of a nerd, and I was surprised to see how much of this is totally true. And the things that he says, you know, when somebody calls him Elvis the Pelvis, he says that's the most stupid thing an adult person could say. He actually said that, you know, like he did actually go down to a gospel tent and was moved by the spirit and the music that happened. So it feels like Baz, who's co-written this with Craig Pierce, has really done his homework on this and really tried to show that Elvis is more than just the white jumpsuit. So for me, I think it's a great film for either fans of Elvis. He's reborn, if you like, in Austin's performance. You know, you're like, oh, I never got to see Elvis in Las Vegas. This is the closest you can get without making a hologram and you know, which they might do, bearing in mind the ABBA thing that's currently on. But it really is a taste of what it might have been like to have been sitting in the audience when he came on and did Suspicious Minds and was in this jumpsuit and had the full orchestra, and what that might have been like. Or if you were in 1957 at the Louisiana Hayride and you were expecting someone to come on and do something sweet, and he came on in a pink suit and just started rocking out, and your emotions bubbled up out of you because you didn't know what you're watching. I think it really captures that. So I love this film. It's probably going to be my film of the year. Think it'll be rating highly on your list?
Yeah, I think it'll be yeah. High. Always difficult to make a prediction halfway through the year, because we still haven't had those
the Oscar
autumn,
ones.
Yeah, the Oscar kind of movies that will come. But Yeah, it's definitely high. I'm not a massive Lerman fan, strangely enough. I remember seeing Moulin Rouge in Cannes and quite enjoying it. Then I went for a second viewing, and I thought, oh my God, how did I like this? It's awful.
What's wrong with you? It's amazing.
I know. Well, you know, Gatsby I thought was okay. Australia, not great. Strictly Ballroom is brilliant. I think that's probably his most pure film in some ways.
Romeo and Juliet. Amazing.
I was absolutely obsessed with Romeo and Juliet. So when it came out, I literally watched it like every day when I got it on VHS. Like it was one of those true kind of.
And played the CD. Did you have the CD with the?
Yeah, I had the two volumes of the soundtrack, of course. Mm. You know, and just absolutely loved that. But this to me was easily his best film since.
Yes, I agree.
Because it's strange, obviously, he hasn't really made that many films. Obviously, he did Get Down for Netflix as well. And, you know, The Great Gatsby was quite a long time ago, wasn't it? So it's been quite a long time coming. But this definitely felt like kind of a return to form in that sense. After I, like James, I was a bit kind of colder on Australia and The Great Gatsby. So this to me was a real return to form. And it won't be my number one film of the year, but I'd be surprised. It'd be an amazing year if it's not in my top 10 at least.
Well, yes. Does Top Gun edge it out?
Yes. Yeah, for me. Yeah. Top Gun's sort of the one to beat for me at the moment, I think, really. This, like Top Gun, I saw this on an IMAX screen. Although it's, you know, what in many ways you can think of as like a lot of these films, you think of them as like adult films or whatever, but
not very like that.
Much, no, not like that. I mean, let's say grown-up films. I'll rephrase that, grown-up films. But it very, very much, I would say, if you get a chance, do see this on a big screen, because just with the music and everything, it really, really, really felt worth that. Like if people are thinking, oh, it sounds all right, but it sounds like the kind of film I'd save to watch at home, it very, very much warrants a cinema trip, I would say.
That's what I've got to convince my father to actually go to the cinema and not save it. And he was like, oh, no, I'll watch it at home when it comes out on DVD. But, you know, I need to convince him to go to the big screen. Mm.
And I also think that it's sort of designed to be seen with an audience anyway, isn't it? That you're supposed to feel as though you're in the audience of those performances and feeling excited. And, you know, if spontaneous clapping happens, then it probably would add to the atmosphere. So, yes, go and see Elvis on the biggest screen with the best sound system that you can. It is out in cinemas on Friday.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
So that's Lerman and Butler's Elvis, but he's obviously been depicted on films before. So what's your favourite movie incarnation of Elvis, James?
Pretty obvious one, but I do love True Romance, where he is, Elvis is played by Val Kilmer, and he's Clarence's sort of conscience, basically, sitting there in the gold jacket, giving him kind of a pep talk. I think you hear a little bit of Snatch of Heartbreak Hotel at one point that he's singing. Yeah, it's obviously Quentin Tarantino's script, Tony Scott directs. Really interesting use of Elvis. And I suppose it's not quite Elvis, but Nicolas Cage in Wild at Heart effectively channels Elvis.
Yeah.
And that was just before True Romance as well. So I guess those two almost feel like a pair to me in a way.
Yeah, Matt.
And for me, I'm going to go for Kurt Russell in John Carpenter's TV movie Elvis from 1979. Kurt Russell's obviously just extremely charismatic, great hair. So, you know, an ideal Elvis, really. What more do you need?
But probably now we've seen Butler, not that great a performance comparatively.
I don't think he did any of the singing either, did he?
No.
From remember, it was all kind of dubbed. So that probably, again, would perhaps jar. But I'll keep the fond memories of the Carpenter version.
Did you like the fact that Lerman put that little Easter egg into Elvis, that he does this montage of Elvis's films that he made in Hollywood, the string of sort of films that were sort of matinee song and dance films, and he put a little clip of It Happened at the World's Fair, which has Kurt Russell as a little child kicking Elvis in the shins, and he put that clip in. So Elvis, the last person to portray Elvis, is actually in Elvis.
That's a very good spot, Jane. I hadn't spotted
that passed me by, because I would like to see this again, because I've only seen it once, and there's obviously so much going on in Elvis that, you know, you kind of probably do need a couple of viewings to take it all in, because it throws a lot at you.
I also like the Easter egg that he says, "I will always love you" to Priscilla, which was the song he sang to her by Dolly Parton on their divorce day. There you go. Anyway, my Elvis, I have to say, and I'd forgotten about this, but it made me laugh, was the fact that Tom Hanks is in this film, in Elvis, but also Forrest Gump, where if legend tells us the truth about Forrest Gump, he inspired Elvis with his dancing. And so you get that little scene where Forrest as a child in his calipers is like trying to dance in front of the TV whilst this unnamed but obvious to identify guitarist is strumming in the lounge, and it's like, do that dance again. And it's like, oh, that's where Elvis's dancing came from. We know now from Baz that that's not, but I like that little nod to him. Okay, there's also, I mean, 3,000 Miles from Graceland, which is Kevin Costner as a bad guy in Vegas wearing the suit and the quiff. If I can get Kevin Costner into any conversation, I will. Yeah. Okay, it is time now then to move on from Elvis the pelvis to Stranger Danger with this.
I am a part-time magician.
Are those black balloons in there?
Would you like to see a magic trick?
I have an announcement to make. One of our students, Finney Blake, was abducted.
What if I could help the police find Finney?
Doesn't work. Not since I was a kid.
I'll scream. I'll scratch your face.
This face?
So this is The Black Phone from Blumhouse Productions. James, tell us about The Black Phone.
Well, The Black Phone is directed by Scott Derrickson, who previously made, Doctor Strange, of course, the first Doctor Strange, but more aptly for this, Sinister, which he did with Ethan Hawke. And Hawke is back as The Grabber, as he's sort of nicknamed. The setting is 1978, a sort of North Denver suburb. And kids are going missing, and the grabber is responsible. We don't see him initially because the main focus of the film is a young school kid called Finney, played by Mason Shaw, who's kind of, you know, bullied by a bunch of kids. Even his younger sister, Gwen, played by Madeline McGraw, has to help him at one point where he's being beaten up by the kids. He befriends this kid called Robin, who is actually my favorite character in the film, played by Miguel Caseros Mora, who's this kind of long-haired kid who's really good at fighting, loves the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I think was quite a funny little point. And he sort of defends Finney at one point from these bullies. But then Robin disappears, and then we come to realize that Robin's been the next victim of the grabber. And then Finney is the next victim of the grabber. He suddenly wakes up in this awful sort of cell. He's sort of, you know, chained up, and there is Ethan Hawke at his most terrifying, basically. In this cell is a black phone, sort of an old style phone. And the Hawke character sort of says, oh, it's disconnected, hasn't worked for years. But it soon rings, and there are voices on the end of the phone. And it turns out those voices are actually from past victims who are very much confused as to why they're talking to Finney. And I won't say too much more than that, but these victims may try and help Finney in some way as he tries to escape this horrendous predicament.
Yes. James has been generous there and given away less than the trailer gives away.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't watch the trailer of this because the entire film is in it. So, James, did it give you the chills? Did it work for you? I mean, Blumhouse has this amazing output. This felt a little bit different in as much as it's so very specifically 70s. I mean, does it work for you?
No. I really like the 70s vibe, the setting. It's hard to talk about what was clever about the film without giving away the last, let's say, third or the last half, because there is some elements that are really, really clever. But as a scary film, it didn't really do much for me. Although I think Hawke is very, very unnerving. He sort of announces himself as this sort of part-time magician. He's got this kind of really imposing black transit van. I mean, all...
Which surely people in the neighbourhood would have noticed.
You would think, wouldn't you? It's even got abracadabra written on it or something. It's just...
I just feel like the logic on this is totally shot at. Like, the reality of this is, I know it's the 70s. I know people don't have camera phones and blah, blah, blah. And there's not CCTV. But it just feels like this guy is operating in such a small circle of victims. And... weird and black balloons and all the rest of it. And then things that happen in the film are like, come on, you would have been caught before now if you were that stupid. Yeah, it just doesn't hang together for me. But as an experience, Matt?
I kind of felt it was fine, yeah, if I wasn't completely blown away by it. It was sort of perfectly acceptable entertainment. I think if you, again, turn up to the cinema to see it in the mood for a bit of a horror film, I don't think many people would come away thinking, oh, that was terrible or anything. There's some sort of interesting ideas. There's some nice, over the top in a way, but nicely so, kind of production design for the era, kind of very much placing it in the late 70s. And so in that sense, it sort of gives it a bit of a sort of Stranger Things vibe or something like that, maybe, where it feels very kind of knowingly sort of retro. And I, as anyone who listens to this or knows me in real life, I'm a huge Ethan Hawke fan.
Yeah.
So it was kind of interesting to see him do something a bit different. But I mean, I don't think it will be one of the sort of all-time memorable screen villains or anything. It's got a really, really great mask, a mask that's very...
Yeah, I mean, your Halloween creepy. Costume is sorted if you fancy going out as the Grabber. Yeah. That's Halloween costume. Yeah.
That's far and away the most memorable thing about the film. It's just this really creepy, like, you know, sort of stone looking kind of mask with a sort of a huge grin, but it can also be changed. And it's kind of the top and bottom are sort of detachable. So sometimes he just has the sort of bottom portion of the mask on. So it's a very, very creepy visual. And again, I wonder if I'd have felt slightly different about the film if the trailer hadn't given quite so much away beforehand. And I kind of, you know, unfolded a bit more in front of me for the first time. Also, I felt like it never entirely blended that well together. There was kind of interesting elements throughout, but it didn't all blend that well, such as with the sort of almost supernatural powers of Finney's younger sister. She sort of has this almost Shining-esque, you know, power where she's able to sort of sense things that are happening or see and sees things in her dreams. And that never entirely then meshed for me with the serial killer story side of it, and the sort of, as you were saying, Jane, there's certain like plot hole type things that you wonder how does this go unnoticed, how is this person getting away with driving around in this very distinctive black van at a time where five children have already been sort of kidnapped. It just didn't all quite gel together for me, and like didn't quite understand why the Grabber was keeping Finney in his basement for so long. Didn't quite ever get the sense of like why has he got him, why is he not sort of, you know, killing him, or sort of, you know, doesn't seem to have any kind of any real reason for having him there.
We don't get any backstory at all for the Grabber, which is probably a good thing. I mean, he's this sort of malevolent force on some level.
I don't know, you do get a bit. I mean, I think it was going in an interesting direction. Well, I thought it was going in, and then it didn't. It does talk a lot about sort of childhood trauma and the sins of the father. So Finney and his sister have this alcoholic, physically abusive father, which were some of the strongest scenes for me, the sort of the dynamics in that family. Their mother has died and he's the lone parent and he is not coping well with it. So they are products of an abusive household. And then the Grabber does say, you know, that phone hasn't worked since I was a kid. And you do wonder whether he is the product of an abusive household as well. So I thought this might be a study about, you know, how hurt people or something like that. And then it decided to just dispense with that and go in a completely different direction. And it will almost forget about Finney's father being such a deadbeat. And it just forgot about that whole element.
I just didn't buy, though, that the resolution with Finney's father, played by Jeremy Davis, who is a great actor, but... With a great mullet. But I just didn't think it was earned at the end at all.
Not at all.
But
that's exactly what I said, because me and Jane saw the film at the same time, and that's exactly what I said afterwards. And it's sort of, he's so kind of horrible early on that when he has any kind of, you know, when he shows any sort of remorse, I just kind of couldn't forgive him because he was just so awful. Yeah, so I didn't really like that. And then I found the film was tonally a bit odd like that in a way as well, that, you know, sort of odd moments, because it's very, very much kind of mainstream film, you know, very, very enjoyable, and, you know, one feels designed sort of play to a crowd in a way. But there was moments where on the one hand, you're kind of like laughing at the sort of younger sister character who's...
calling people a fart knocker.
Yeah, swearing, beating people up. And we're kind of, you know, encouraged to sort of laugh along at that. But then it will kind of jump into a scene of like horrific domestic abuse, you know, and I just never quite felt those tones fully added up.
I will say there was a fantastic use of Pink Floyd's On the Run, which is from Dark Side of the Moon, which is in the kind of final third where it's really kind of ramping up. It's this sort of, I can't even describe the music, but it's just a really kind of trippy, hallucinogenic track that they did. Mm. And he uses that really, really well in that sort of final third. But that was the highlight for me, was mainly because I love that album. But
it had a sort of almost Guardians of the Galaxy vibe to the soundtrack, I thought. I think there was literally a song that's in one of the, I can't remember which one it is, but there was a song that's in one of the Guardians films. It kind of felt like it was playing to a crowd, but perhaps something about it just didn't quite work for me. Something didn't quite add up. The fantasy elements didn't quite gel with the sort of, you know, serial killer horror elements to me.
Yeah. I mean, the title sequence got me really excited, tonally and visually. That was the most terrifying bit of the film, and cracking sort of really set a tone that,
that's not a good sign. That's not a good sign, though, when the title sequence is the scariest thing.
And what it reminded me of was like Seven, you know, the title sequence of Seven, with that, you know, that music and that those visuals. And like, oh, I was like, God, what am I going to get a Seven? I didn't get a Seven. Mm. I got a 3. But it's perfectly decent, but not great.
It's not on the Sinister level, which I thought Sinister was a fantastic, scary movie. And
genuinely disquieting, that one.
Yeah, but this doesn't quite come up to that level.
Okay, so that is The Black Phone. If you want to see it and get a minor chill, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, time for alternative line reading. Are you ready for this? And as always, this is somebody we've talked about already on this pod, one of their lines in one of their films, but done in the wrong style. So I think I'm probably going to do this in the style of a grabber. You ready? The best thing about visiting the president is the food. They put you in this little room with just about anything you want to eat or drink. And since number one, I wasn't hungry, but thirsty. And number two, it was all free. I must have drunk me about 15 Dr. Peppers.
That was terrifying. That should have been in... The Black
Phone. Ethan should have opened with that, right?
Yeah.
He does bring him a Sprite. Maybe it should have been 15 Dr. Peppers. So what film is that from?
It's got to be someone from Elvis, right? I mean, but it can't be Austin Butler because he hasn't done enough movies. So
he has done quite a lot of Nickelodeon ones that you've not seen.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So it could be from that. It's got to be a Hanks quote, I'm sure.
Correct. But what?
I've got to let James guess because I've accidentally seen the answer on James' notes, so it wouldn't be fair to
cheat. Cheat.
No, it was a complete accident. But I must say, I don't think I would have got it if I.
I think we talked about it though, didn't we, earlier? Wasn't it your favourite Elvis featuring movie, Forrest Gump?
Correct. And this is what it sounds like.
Now, the really good thing about meeting the President of the United States is the food. They put you in this little room with just about anything you want to eat or drink. And since number one, I wasn't hungry but thirsty. And number two, they was free. I must have drank me about 15 Dr. Peppers.
So that's it for this week. If you're going to watch one film, Black Phone or Elvis, which is it going to be, boys?
Elvis, thank you very
absolutely
much.
Absolutely Elvis for me, but I mean, that's an interesting mix. There's something for everyone.
Okay, we should mention as well that our new issue is out, which has a feature on Elvis in it. It has an interview with Baz Luhrmann. I spoke to the wonderful Baz about his career and why he is the rebel himself. It's also got what on the cover, Matt?
Thor, Love and Thunder.
Yes.
Yes. I obviously had the amazing job of speaking to basically everyone on Thor, Love and Thunder, like Taika Waititi, Chris Hemsworth, Natalie Portman, Christian Bale, Tessa Thompson, Kevin Feige, and they were all genuinely like as kind of fun as you'd expect. Christian Bale, perhaps being the biggest, surprised me in terms of just how funny he was. Obviously, he has a kind of very serious reputation, very intense on screen, and he looks like he's playing this absolutely terrifying character in Thor, Love and Thunder. But he was just absolutely hilarious. And the others were all great too, so that was obviously enormous fun. So that's out now. As you read this, that's out now.
It's out on digital, Thursday. So. Get it in your eyes. And it's a gorgeous cover. It's really psychedelic and 80s, so we love it. So thank you, Taika Waititi, for sending that over. That is a corker.
And I also think this is an issue that you will regret if you're not a Total Film subscriber. because it's just got one of the most glorious subscriber exclusive covers.
It is an absolute beauty. Yes.
If you don't want to miss stuff like that in future, you know what to do.
Yeah.
So if you want to subscribe and you know, get the cool exclusive subscriber covers in future, you've got to go to magazinesdirect.com and find Total Film on there.
Yeah, and there's some extremely good deals on at the moment as well. So do it. Right, we will be back next week. But before we go, there is time for a listener's question. What's the biopic you'd like to see made and who would you cast? Matt?
Well, I'm going to sort of cheat on this one in a sense that it is someone who has had a few biopics made, and I've actually mentioned one earlier today, but I feel like the definitive one still needs to happen. And there's one actor I particularly want to see in it who I've also mentioned, which is I would like to see a Steve Jobs biopic starring Christian Bale, just because I think he would be sort of perfect casting sort of looks wise. And I just would love to see him kind of tackle Jobs as a character over the years. Yeah, we've had various versions. We've had the Ashton Kutcher version. We had the Noah Wyle version as like a TV movie a long time ago. But yes, I'd love to see one, especially one that sort of digs into the sort of rivalry with Bill Gates as well. I don't know who I'd cast as Bill Gates. If that left me stumped. Michael Cera, maybe, if he sort of was aged up a bit.
Put some glasses on him.
Yes, but I just want to see Bale as Steve Jobs, and especially as he kind of almost got close to it when they were first sort of working on the version that became the Fassbender Boyle version. But I wish that had have come to pass. Yes, so that would be my hope for the future.
Cool. James?
I am looking forward, first of all, to the Madonna, directed by Madonna. It's got a cast, lead cast member, Julia Garner. I think she's a great actress and really does seem to capture Madonna in that early 80s kind of, or mid 80s era. But I was having a think about this. I'd love to see a Marlon Brando film. I don't think there's been one, unless you can correct me. But I was thinking, who on earth could play him? We could basically get Austin Butler to do early Brando and Hanks in his fat suit to do late Brando. What do you think? Wow. Elvis reunion, right?
I'm totally into it. Yeah. I wonder with Butler whether he'd ever touch another biopic ever. Yeah. But then I see that, you know, Jessica Chastain went from Tammy Faye to doing Tammy Wynette. So maybe.
One thing which I wonder about Austin Butler, though, I was going to say this during our Elvis review, but is he's kind of so good and so sort of electric and so sort of memorable as Elvis. You almost don't want to see him play anyone else afterwards.
He should retire now. Yeah.
But no doubt he will.
Well, his next project is Masters of the Skies, I think. The World War
II. I thought you were going to say Masters of the Universe, like he was playing He-Man or something.
I mean, but I think people would pay for that. So yeah, we will see what he does next. Yeah, my biopic is, when I was talking to Baz Luhrmann, he talked about the fact that he was interested in making his own biopic, an autobiopic. And I was like, I think that would be really quite interesting if he directed it. And it was about, you know, this boy living in Herons Creek in the middle of nowhere at this gas station, being obsessed with movies, doing ballroom dancing, running away to drama school, getting together with this sort of group of misfits. And, you know, he's done bits in opera, he's done stage shows, he's been in a band. He then sort of decided to do Strictly Ballroom Against All Odds and took it to Cannes. And it became this sort of cult hit. And then the amount of people he knows. I mean, this guy drops names like nobody's business. You know, Bowie was his friend. His mates with Elton. He and Jay-Z and Beyonce hang out. You know, like, he knows all these people. So I think this would be a really fabulous walk through his life. And I think Taika Waititi would be great as older Baz with the white quiff. And I'd like to see, like, all famous people coming into his life and just him hanging out with them. And his wonderful wife, CM, Catherine Martin, who is his production designer and costume designer on his films. And she basically brings his vision to life. And the fact that they sort of live together and have date nights but make these fabulous confections. Yeah, I'd totally buy a ticket for that.
There we go.
Would you?
Like it. Yeah. Because funny enough, isn't Spielberg doing his sort of next film is a sort of autobiopic, or at least inspired by his early years. I think if you did a Baz one, those early years you were talking about would probably be the most interesting, how he got that start and the sort of, because he was a ballroom dancer, wasn't he, when he was quite young. And I think translating that into Strictly Ballroom would be a really interesting transition, I suppose. You know, that's a key moment in his life, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also, you know, with all of the sort of flourish that he brings to his films and the verve, you could imagine him telling that story in quite a eye-popping fashion. So yeah, Baz, do it. Do it. We're here for it. Okay, that's all we have time for. So it's time to say goodbye. Do it in your best Elvis sign-off. Goodbye, Matt.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, James.
Goodbye. Thank you, everyone.
It's pretty good. And it's goodbye for me. Uh-huh. Jumping and the jump again to swing. You should have heard those knocked out jailbirds.